Rewind is an award-winning insider's look at Wisconsin politics and public policy. Brought to you by Wisconsin Eye and wispolitics.com. To become a program sponsor, please send an email to rewind@wiseye.org.
I believe united we stand, and we have common ground to find, and we're going to find it. We're not even going to use it.
I'm Sean Johnson.
And I'm Patrick Marley.
This is Rewind. Steve and JR are off this week, but thankfully, Patrick, we have no shortage of news, some budget positioning,
Today,
a big ruling by the Wisconsin Supreme Court in one of the lame duck cases that is working its way through the court system. We'll talk about that in a moment, but first, WISEye was there.
Publicly displaying the Rainbow Pride flag sends a clear and unequivocal message that Wisconsin is a welcoming and inclusive place where everybody can live without fear of persecution, judgment, and discrimination.
Literally, Wisconsin is the hole in the donut right now. Minnesota, Iowa, Illinois, Indiana, Ohio, Michigan, all passed similar legislation. They're spending tens and hundreds of millions of dollars with 5G infrastructure investment in those states.
We gotta balance those safeguards. People are there because they're in trauma and they're in a vulnerable place. And part of the reason I have so much respect for Adoption to Wisconsin and the social workers and agencies here in Wisconsin is I believe deeply that they have the best interests of the birth mother, the child, and the adoptive parents at heart and are working to find the best situation that they can.
Something that I really think could help with kids in schools is DBT, which stands for Diabetical Behavioral Therapy. And what DBT is, it teaches kids about coping skills and how they can deal with their emotions. And not only it could help kids, but it could also help teachers as well deal with their kids.
Today, Senator Roth and I are going to take the final legislative step by signing the four pro-life bills that were passed earlier this session. I would ask that you join me in demanding that Governor Evers listens to us, he listens to the people of Wisconsin, and that Governor Evers signs these bills.
All right, that was video from Governor Tony Evers at an inaugural Pride Month celebration outside the Wisconsin State Capitol. You heard some assembly debate this week. That was on a bill dealing with 5G infrastructure. Two speakers task force events on suicide prevention and adoption. And that last bit of video was a rally at the state capitol by GOP leaders and anti-abortion activists calling on Governor Evers to sign four bills that would restrict abortion in Wisconsin. Governor Evers has said he will veto the bills. Patrick, we have some news today to talk about with a ruling handed down by Wisconsin's Supreme Court in one of the lame duck cases. This is the case that was brought by the League of Women Voters of Wisconsin. Mm-hmm. Strictly a procedural case. And in this case, the Supreme Court's conservative majority dismissed the lawsuit, upheld the lame duck session. You heard Justice Rebecca Bradley writing for the majority in the 4-3 decision. She said, quote, "The terminology the legislature chooses to accomplish the legislative process is squarely the prerogative of the legislature. The Wisconsin Constitution itself affords the legislature absolute discretion to determine the rules of its own proceedings." Justice Rebecca Dallet wrote the dissent. She said, quote, "The legislature violated the plain constitutional text, and this court must act as a check." Patrick, put this case in some context here. This was a procedural challenge. What was argued, and what does this decision mean here for those laws that were passed in December?
So the lame duck laws, which limit the powers of the Democratic governor and Democratic attorney general, have been challenged in all kinds of ways. This case sort of attacks it on the most fundamental level and says the way that the Republican legislators brought themselves into session in December was invalid. They held what's called an extraordinary session, which essentially means they bring themselves to the Capitol at a time when they're not otherwise scheduled to be there. And the challengers, which was the Wisconsin League of Women Voters and some other groups, said the Constitution doesn't allow that. The Constitution says you can come in as provided by law or when there's a special session held by the governor. And they say, as provided by law, there's not a specific law that dictates when extraordinary sessions can be held. The Supreme Court said, nope, we show deference to the legislature. They determine the rules of their own proceedings. The law just says they have to set a work schedule. They set a work schedule that allowed them to basically come into session at any time. Therefore, these laws were enacted properly. Not a big surprise here, given that the arguments in the case, it was very clear that the conservatives on the court were on the side of the Republicans on this issue, and the liberals on the court were going to be in dissent, and that's exactly how it fell, 4-3. Yeah.
You heard a couple of the conservatives on the court during arguments all but say,
yes.
You know, state that they disagreed with plaintiffs in this case. This was interesting because I think we both covered extraordinary sessions at the Capitol and thought they were pretty commonplace
yes.
things. Then you start to look back, and they are a relatively recent creature yep. in the world of Wisconsin state government, only been around for about 40 years, been
yes.
a couple dozen of them. They don't go back to statehood.
Right.
Like special sessions do, but the Supreme Court, the majority in the court, was unmoved by this idea that they are new and unconstitutional.
Right. I mean, they did start in 1980, so you're right that it's like relatively new, but also, you know, everybody in the Capitol knows about them, and they've gone unchallenged all this time. So it was a novel concept to come up with this, but the Supreme Court was not having any of it. And so, you know, now we go to a few more cases. Given the makeup of the state Supreme Court, it would seem that the Democrats are going to be in a tough spot to knock out these laws.
Okay, so talk us through where we are now, because this was a procedural case. They're
right.
saying you could meet in this extraordinary session. You can't strike down these laws or these appointments just on procedural grounds. But
right.
there's another case before the Supreme Court.
That's
this
right.
was brought by the Service Employees International Union
yep.
and others. What's different about that one?
So that case actually gets to the substance of the lame duck laws, which are very broad. They do a lot of different things. And so they challenge specific provisions saying that it's a violation of the separation of power. So they say essentially the legislature has gone too far in stepping into the administration of government, that instead of legislating, it's executing state laws. And they had some success before a Dane County judge who struck down or put on hold a number of the lame duck laws. And that got appealed. The Supreme Court has put almost all of those back into place while it considers this lawsuit. And so it's going to hold arguments in the coming months, and then we'll render a final ruling. In the meantime, given the decision today and its past order, the vast majority of the lame duck laws are in effect. One provision would have restricted early voting, and that has been struck down by a federal judge, and that doesn't appear to be coming back anytime soon. And then the other one is part of a provision on what are called guidance documents, which basically tell the public how the state administers state laws. Part of that law has been knocked down. Otherwise, the rest of them are in effect.
So let's talk about that the early voting restrictions real quick. That's in one of the federal cases. This is actually an offshoot of a federal case
That's
from
right.
a few years ago.
Yes.
Which is kind of interesting that this is still kind of floating out there in limbo
yeah.
with the Federal Court of Appeals.
Yes.
Where did that case originate? And
sure.
why is this the provision we're talking about with the lame duck session?
So a few years ago, the liberal group won Wisconsin Now, or actually it's an affiliate of it,
mm-hmm.
sued over a number of voting restrictions that Republicans had passed in recent years. And there was a court order that struck down many of them, including a provision that had limited early voting to about 2 weeks. Prior to that, it had been completely determined at the local level how much early voting there was. That was struck down in the lame duck laws. The Republicans put back into effect a nearly identical restriction on early voting, so putting it back to 2 weeks. It was a little bit different, but not much. As soon as that law was passed, the original plaintiffs went back to court and said, this looks like it's in violation of the injunction you issued a couple of years ago, and the federal judge, James Peterson, agreed with that and sidelined that part of the lame duck law. Now, that whole case over all kinds of voting provisions is before the Seventh Circuit in Chicago.
For years now.
For years. It's like 2 or 3 years, which is a very long time for an appeal to remain pending after arguments. No one knows why. No one knows what's going up with that. So there could be a lot of changes to election laws, or they could uphold the lower court ruling. We don't know what's going on with that one.
Okay, so despite today's ruling by the Wisconsin Supreme Court, that law, that portion of the law, is still on hold. You also have
That's
this
right.
other federal case brought by the Democratic Party of Wisconsin
Yes.
in federal court. That challenges everything, basically.
Yes.
And where's that one?
So that one is in very early stages, and that one basically says that it's a violation of the First Amendment rights of Democrats to have changed the law at the last minute after Evers and Attorney General Call are elected, to have the Republicans change the rules at that late date damages their First Amendment rights. And that case has a long road before we'll really probably get any rulings out of that one.
Okay. And do we know steps that Governor Evers or Josh Call, the Attorney General, took while these laws were considered unconstitutional by a lower court?
Yes.
Do those stand? You know, they pulled out of the federal lawsuit.
The Obamacare lawsuit.
The Obamacare lawsuit.
Right.
Are we still out of the Obamacare lawsuit?
Yes, we're still out of the Obamacare lawsuit. So that was one thing that the lame duck laws did, is they said the Democrats couldn't get us out of cases like the Obamacare lawsuit. And when lower courts struck these down temporarily, that's what they did. They went and they got us out of the case. And the state Supreme Court has said, well, we sort of can't put that genie back in the bottle. We're not going to go try to get the state back into that case. I suppose the Republican lawmakers could go file a petition in federal court to try to get Wisconsin involved in the case again, but that appears to be
unlikely. They don't seem like they're signaling that they want to do that.
I'm not getting that impression
at all.
They're
done with them.
Yeah.
Okay. So let's move on to the budget. There was some news this week on that. You had a couple of GOP lawmakers say that they are going to vote no on the state budget. Senators David Craig and Steve Noss say they'll vote no. Senator Steve Noss said, quote, "This is not a conservative budget by any reasonable analysis." Noss cited the property tax increase in the budget, the structural deficit, the overall spending increase, the capital budget, the increases in the vehicle registration and title fees, a new mileage-based transportation fee. Senator Dave Craig, when he announced his opposition, said, "I kind of agree with everything Steve Noss said," but he also talked about the overall spending in the budget, the stewardship program being continued. It didn't sound like there would be a very easy way to get Senator Craig to vote yes for this, given how much he thinks it spends. So what is the significance of this? We have two Republican senators who say they'll vote no. I guess, so what?
Well, the so what is now they have no margin for error. The Republicans control the Senate 19-14. You need everybody but two you can lose. So these two they've lost. So anyone else who defects sinks the budget. And so that really puts all eyes on Chris Kapinga, a Republican from Delafield, who, like Craig and Noss and Senator Dewey Strobel, had been holdouts on the last budget, even though Republicans controlled everything, and worked out a deal with then-Governor Walker for some vetoes. They got some assurances on vetoes, and that got three of the four of them to vote for the budget, got it through. This time, obviously, Tony Evers is not going to be any help to them. And so Republican leaders seem to have written off Noss and Craig, taking them at their word that they can't get them back. Strobel, of course, is on the Joint Finance Committee. In that role, he voted for the budget, the final version of the budget, in committee. He was on talk radio this week and expressed a lot of reservations about the budget, but did seem to be indicating he would hold his nose and vote for it. So it looks like there's going to be some tweaks to the budget. The Republican leaders are hoping that they can make ones that are modest enough that it doesn't freak out other members of their caucus and they can get it passed and get it to Evers. It appears they're probably going to be able to do that. If they're not, though, then we have a real problem with trying to get a budget completed.
So if Kapinga, let's say, were to stick together with Noss and Craig, they could hold this thing up for a while.
They could hold it. I mean, you could. You would have to have, you know, significant changes then to bring one of those three back on board, or you would have to totally alter the budget to start to get Democratic votes, which, you know, they are a long way from being able to get any Democratic votes for this. So it's a key moment. It also, I think, is important to note that, you know, even if they get the votes to get it passed, it doesn't help Republicans with the base to have two of their members out there talking badly about the budget and saying, you know, this is not a good budget, it spends too much. That makes it troubling for somebody who might be running in a primary at some point, for instance, to be getting both from the right, and then, of course, Evers and the Democrats are going to be criticizing the budget from the left. It makes it harder for the Republicans to have sort of a unified message on this budget.
Yeah, I mean, it did, because it didn't sound like Craig or Noss were on the fence about
No, it sure didn't.
And they would be at the top of any list if you're wondering who is going to maybe vote against this. I think you would definitely speculate them. But
absolutely. I mean, Craig, despite those veto assurances, Craig voted against the last budget, and Noss, who was in the Assembly before the Senate, has a long career of voting against budgets. So it's not a real shocker that these are the two outliers publicly at this point.
Okay. So at least according to his public comments, Governor Tony Evers hasn't given up hope yet on a bipartisan budget. He had some remarks this week to reporters about the budget. So did Assembly Speaker Robin Voss. Let's hear a little bit about what they had to say.
Once I see the entire budget, then I'll make the decision on whether we veto an entire budget. My goal is to get our budget passed, and I'm hopeful that this further dialogue that they're having, they'll recognize that, no, it isn't a budget that's too high. It's a budget that doesn't meet the needs of the people of Wisconsin.
We believe that after listening to people, the budget that we're going to present is very representative of what our constituents want. We feel this is a reasonable compromise. It achieves his goals, but also sticks to our principles. And I think that's why, in the end, he should sign it.
So there you heard Assembly Speaker Robin Voss, and before him, Governor Tony Evers. Voss is saying, you know, hey, let's sign this budget. This is a good budget. Governor Tony Evers definitely keeping his options open. Evers told reporters he won't make any decisions on the budget until he sees what comes out of both houses, but he did criticize the GOP plans to increase vehicle registration fees and title fees instead of raising the gas tax, as the governor proposed. Voss said this week that he thinks the GOP transportation plan would cost the average motorist less than Evers' budget. And just going back to what Governor Evers has said on the budget this week, Patrick, it seems to me like a governor who is very much keeping his options open.
Absolutely.
He's not going to say he's going to veto it.
That's right.
He's saying that they have an opportunity, Republicans have an opportunity to do the right thing, support the people's budget, as he yes. calls it over and over again.
Yes.
However, look how far they've come, he says. Look yes. how much better this budget is because I proposed it. So where do you think the governor is in that mix of positions?
Well, I mean, I don't think a budget, since we started this two-year budgeting process, like in the 1930s, no governor has ever vetoed a budget in its entirety. The governor has incredible powers to, you know, strike out individual words and provisions of a budget. So he has got the advantage. He has the last word on the budget. But I think there's a rhetorical advantage to him to say, to leave open the prospect, like, well, I may veto the whole thing, because he is right that although Republicans and he disagree dramatically on these budget issues, Republicans have kind of catered to him in how they've structured parts of the budget. They've put money into his priorities: education, health care, and finding money for roads. They have a tax cut, but it's geared very much toward the middle class and lower classes, so it's sort of a Democratic structure to a tax cut rather than a Republican one. But, you know, I think it's he wants to have the ability to hold out the prospect that he can veto the whole thing. But don't you think that would be a pretty unusual move for him to make, given what this budget looks like?
I think you start with the fact that it hasn't happened since 1931, and I was surprised about that. Actually, I didn't know that going into this budget cycle, because I've heard governors threaten a prospect of a veto right. over and over again. Governor Doyle used to do it. Governor yes. Walker even did it with Republicans.
Right.
But it's never happened. So it seems like, you know, the chances of it, just based on history, are kind of slim. And when you hear the governor talking about, look how much better this budget is than it would have been had I not been governor,
right.
he's at least giving himself the option of signing this budget that's not exactly what he wanted.
Right.
And again, with the mandatory veto.
I mean, it's interesting because we've had such a fight over the budget for all these months, but at the end of the day, you could have him vetoing out certain provisions, then going around the state and championing it. Look at all the good things. Anything bad about it is Republicans' fault. And Republicans simultaneously going out and saying, look at the good things. Those are because of us. And any bad things happened because Tony Evers either forced us to do it or vetoed out some good policy or some good spending decisions that we had made.
Yeah, and at least at this point, they seem to be very happy or on the same page, a number of them anyway, on the capital budget. A $1.9 yes. billion capital budget is, I was surprised to see that come out of the Finance Committee that way. They're on the same page almost entirely with the governor, aside from a few big projects.
That's right. I was surprised too, because especially in the early stages, I think Governor Evers had $2.5 billion, and Republicans you know, sort of turned white at that number. Like, that's way too much spending. And in fact, in the Building Commission had voted against every single project, saying they needed more time to review them. But they came to a number that was much closer to Evers than we might have suspected from the beginning of the process.
So let's talk about a provision of the budget that's getting a lot of attention these days, this new mileage-based fee study that was added to the budget by Republicans when they passed the transportation budget out of the Joint Finance Committee. This would be a $2.5 million study. This mileage-based fee could refer to tolls, or it could refer to mileage-based vehicle registration fees. Yep. It'd be kind of up to the Department of Transportation to decide which direction to go with that. The firm contracted to do the study would report its findings to the DOT and the legislature by December of 2022, and the DOT would have to submit a recommendation for a fee by January of 2023. The Finance Committee would be required to vote on the plan, and the plan would not go to the full legislature for a vote under the version that passed the Finance Committee. There'd be no limits on the size of the fee. The governor could veto it, but under the plan that passed the Finance Committee, the Finance Committee could override him.
Yes.
Patrick, where do we stand with this proposal
right now? Well,
that
sounds like more than just a study.
Yeah.
Where we stand with this right now is Speaker Voss said just the other day that they're going to change that. That is one of the provisions are going to change, and that they're not going to leave it to just the Finance Committee to take the vote. It would be required of the full legislature. That is probably the provision that got the most scrutiny and the most concern from both Democrats and Republicans, was this idea that 16 of the state's 132 legislators could decide on a whole, not just on raising a fee, but creating a new fee, including one that some are critical of as a big brother potential element by having a device in your car that would track how many miles you drive. There was a lot of opposition to that, and that's a recognition of this. In fact, Voss says, well, this was never our intention to have just this committee do it. We wanted the full legislature to do it. Now, I think the question is that going to be enough of a change? Because there may be concerns of others about going to a mileage-based system instead of a more traditional gas tax, or even tolling, which is, although we don't have it in Wisconsin, people are familiar with it because of Illinois. The concept is not as new as this mileage-based fee notion.
Right, and in the last budget, which went into September, there was a $2.5 million study that would have implemented tolling in Wisconsin. It seems, I can't help but note, but that this is the same dollar figure here. And that bothered some Republican senators at the time enough that they got Governor Walker to take it out. I haven't heard Governor Evers draw a line in the sand on this exactly. He's criticized it, but has he said he would veto it?
I was able to talk to him about it, and he did not give an assurance that he would veto it, but he expressed a lot of skepticism. The way he put it is, there's criticism of that both in the legislative branch and the executive branch. So he sort of hinted that it may be something that he would veto. Now, at the same time, he has been a big advocate for finding more money for roads. This would be a way to get more money for roads. So if the legislature modifies it somewhat, softens it in some way, maybe he comes around. It's not out of the realm of possibility.
Okay. We'll find out more pretty soon, I think. Moving outside of budget news here briefly, we've got a story this week that your paper reported, Patrick. Lieutenant Governor Mandela Barnes owed delinquent property taxes. The Journal Sentinel reported last week that Barnes had failed to pay at least $2,225 in property taxes. Governor Evers said on Monday that if Barnes owed taxes, he should pay them. Hours later, Barnes tweeted that he had paid the taxes. He said, quote, "You miss a bill, you pay it. Simple, check is in the mail." Patrick, tell us about this story. You know, give us the background on, you know, what happened here with the Lieutenant Governor and where things stand now.
Yeah, it's it comes after a run of some scrutiny of Barnes. He's got security costs that are high above his predecessor, Rebecca Clayfish. He had some unpaid parking tickets. So he had that news out there, and then it comes out that he hadn't paid his property taxes. Now he says he's getting that taken care of. But it's a little bit of a self-inflicted wound. You know, taxes are due in December. It draws a lot of attention to him in a way that he could have avoided had he paid these, or even as the story was being prepared, if he had gotten ahead of it and paid the taxes, that might have saved him some grief.
Okay. I guess we don't know the answer to this question, but is this the kind of story that is just left here? Do we move on here? Or does this, most people don't know who the lieutenant governor is most of the time. Does it affect Governor Evers?
I don't know that it spills over to Governor Evers a lot. I suppose it becomes a distraction for him. As happened this week, he was asked about it, and probably not his favorite question to entertain when he'd rather be talking about budget changes that he'd like to see. I think it becomes a potential issue for Mandela Barnes if he chooses to run for governor or U.S. Senate at some point. It's something that Republicans are ready to pounce on and saying, you shouldn't put a guy in charge of your taxes who can't even pay his own or isn't paying his own. But in the grand scheme of things, is it something that a politician can overcome? Possibly, sure.
All right. The State Assembly met twice this week. Passed a variety of bills, including bills on homelessness and Lincoln Hills. The Lincoln Hills proposal would extend the deadline when the state would close Lincoln Hills, but not by as much as Governor Evers wanted. The homelessness bills would boost funding for programming and shelters. Patrick, let's talk about the homelessness bills first. What would they do, and where are lawmakers on those?
So they put a lot of this into the budget, actually, and then they passed some standalone bills. But it would funnel money into a variety of programs to help shelters, to get people who are homeless from a shelter into an apartment or other place to live more quickly. It would fund what are called housing navigators. So these are people who will work between tenants and landlords to get people to the right places, or to mediate disputes if they're at risk of eviction, and to help recruit landlords into programs that help homeless people. But like I say, these provisions were included in the budget. This provides the funding, sets the money aside for the Finance Committee to dole out at a later point.
Okay, and then Lincoln Hills, this bill would extend the deadline to close Lincoln Hills by 6 months, not as much as Governor Evers wants. Before we talk about that, let's take a listen to some of the debate this week, or some of the discussion, from Republican Representative Michael Schrah and Assembly Democratic Minority Leader Gordon Hintz.
Everything in the timeline that we've laid out with the extra 6 month extension is doable. And we've also inserted into the trailer bill the ability for Lincoln Hills to be able to transfer individuals from Lincoln Hills to other county facilities on a temporary basis. So we will be, closing down Lincoln Hills as of July 1st, 2021.
I'm happy that Representative Goyke, Representative Schrah are staying at the table with the council of the governor and our counties on how we can best move forward with a commitment to closing Lincoln Hills, but also being realistic about, the time frame necessary to try to get it right. It may not be the last time, but this was a substantial change after years and years of neglect. And really ignoring the reforms to our criminal justice system that were necessary. So, again, I'm glad that all parties are at the table for that one.
All right, Patrick, I don't think anybody's written as much about Lincoln Hills as you, maybe your colleague Molly Beck at the Journal Sentinel.
Sure.
But give us some idea of why this is a contentious issue, just extending the deadline for closing Lincoln Hills by 6 months.
Sure.
And what does it mean for these facilities?
Yeah. So, of course, this prison up north has been the cause of a lot of problems, about $25 million in taxpayer settlements and legal bills, a four-year-long criminal investigation of the way staff was conducting themselves. That investigation recently ended without charges. But there have been just story after story about bad practices up there. A settlement to try to reduce the use of pepper spray and solitary confinement. Last year when they passed the law to close it by January 1 of 2021, I think everybody thought that they were putting this chapter of the state behind it. Well, it turns out closing a facility that holds 150, 200 kids and building new ones and having counties instead of state run some of them is more complicated than everybody had thought. They'd put it on a pretty aggressive time frame. Evers says he needs more time than 6 months. As you heard from Representative Schrah, he says he's looked at the time frame. He thinks that urgency is very important, and he thinks that it can be done in 6 months. So this would give them until July. problems we continue to hear about up there. They just had settlements this week for another $5 million for three inmates, one who had his arm broken, two girls who were from Iowa but had been kept here on contract, you know, one of whom said that these girls were in solitary confinement for weeks at a time, alleged that guards rammed their heads into a wall and things like that. They each got nearly $2 million. So very significant costs and troubling reports about the facility.
All right. The Assembly also took up a variety of other bills this week, including some tougher drunk driving penalties. One would make first offenders appear in court. Another would require a mandatory prison sentence for people who kill someone while driving drunk. Not on that list is a bill that comes up pretty regularly but never goes anywhere that would make first offense OWI a crime in Wisconsin. Are we going to see that this session?
No sign of that happening. In fact, Voss this week said that he thinks that the system we have is a good one, where it's a traffic offense the first time, not a crime until your second offense, and that he supports these kinds of rules, law changes that would tighten things. Another thing that one of those laws or bills would do would make it so that a second offense is always a crime. As it stands right now, if a second offense happens more than 10 years after the first offense, it's considered a traffic violation. This would make it a crime, even if it had been 30 years since it had happened.
All right. And there was a ceremony in the Capitol Rotunda this week to honor Justice Shirley Abrahamson. She will be leaving the court, retiring from the court at the end of July. She's been on the court for 43 years. You had a couple governors speak on behalf of Justice Abrahamson. You had former justices who had served with her give a speech in her honor. Diane Sykes, kind of noteworthy there, who's on the Seventh Circuit Court of Appeals and was on President Trump's short list of potential Supreme Court nominees. And then you had U.S. Supreme Court Justice Ruth Bader Ginsburg honor Shirley Abrahamson in a video message. Ruth Bader Ginsburg said, quote, "Among jurists I have encountered in the United States and abroad, Shirley Abrahamson is the very best." That is unequivocal praise there.
Sure
from
is.
A pretty well-known U.S. Supreme Court justice for Shirley Abrahamson, Patrick.
Yes. Shirley Abrahamson, of course, is the first woman on the Supreme Court, longest-serving member of the state's Supreme Court. She was long the Chief Justice until she was removed from that position when there was a constitutional amendment. She's nationally renowned. Liberals love her and her views of the court, and Republicans are going to be very glad to see her go. She'll be replaced by a conservative, and that'll increase the conservative majority on the court to 5-2.
And Shirley Abrahamson, shortly after she announced last year she would not seek another term, announced a few months later that she had cancer.
Yes.
She stood to deliver her address here, and the rotunda stood and cheered for her. She reminded people that she had won four statewide elections.
Yes.
By the way, all above 55% of the votes.
Yes.
Still got a little bit of a competitive streak. She did not run this last time, though, and Justice-elect Brian Hagedorn will be taking office on August 1st.
Yes.
What does that mean for the court?
Well, like I say, it would increase the majority. There's some concern among conservatives that they could lose a seat in 2020. The race will be the same day as the Democratic primary for president. And so Dan Kelly, conservative, is perhaps in danger of losing his seat. Having Brian Hagedorn would give them a cushion there that they would, even if they lost a seat, they would continue to control the court.
All right. That's going to do it for us today. JR and Steve will be back next week when the big news will be, I'm thinking, the Assembly debating the budget and maybe
the Senate
also passing the budget. We'll see. The Assembly's taking the schedule to take it up on Tuesday. I'm Sean Johnson.
I'm Patrick Marley.
That's all for Rewind. Thanks for joining us.